This is Art Moves, a series of curated conversations at the dynamic intersection of art, innovation, and social justice. Each week, we'll be talking to the visionary thinkers and doers who are forging new ground in the creative arts while redefining what it means to be creative. I'm Toni Williams.
And I'm Eli Kaslansky, and we're your hosts for Art Moves.
Today, Eli, today, we have the privilege of speaking with Chrissy Isles, the Anne and Joel Ehrenkranz curator at the Whitney Museum of American Art in New York. Now, Chrissy's work embodies a commitment to pushing boundaries and fostering dialogue within the art world. We are thrilled to delve into her insights on the evolving role of art in today's society. Welcome, Chrissy. Welcome. And what's so interesting, Chrissy, is I got a glimpse of you because I went to the biennial knowing that we were going to be talking to you. And we know we'd like to keep things fresh.
Of her at the biennial?
Yes, I did. I got a glimpse of her speaking to a group of people. But I wanted to talk to you about the biennial. And when I walked in, you know, I'm walking into this art space, this wonderful museum. And in some ways, I felt a little overwhelmed. You know, there were so many pieces. I'm like, what floor do I start on? How does this all fit together? How am I going to absorb all of this? How does one walk into a biennial, especially the Whitney?
Well, first of all, thank you very much, both of you, for having me. It's a real delight to be here. And I'm really thrilled to be with you and talking about the biennial, which I curated with my wonderful co-curator, Meg Only. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because we have in this particular biennial fewer artists than in some. Mm-hmm. And we've given a lot of the work plenty of space. Someone came to us and said, wow, it feels like you've given us our lungs back. So speaking to this particular biennial, what we really were thinking about is the fact that it's appearing after COVID. It's the first biennial to be curated and presented after COVID, mm-hmm. if we can say after, of course, since COVID is still with us. But really more after the pandemic and the heat of the pandemic. And, you know, so one of the key things about the pandemic was this fear of being with other people.
Yes.
In public space. So this biennial is very spacious. It's spacious.
I felt that too. Very airy. Yes. Mm-hmm.
It's spacious not only to give the works room to breathe, and there are also a lot of large scale works, which you can't really see in any other kind of art environment in New York, but also space for us to be together. And that was very important to us. And, you know, we had an ongoing dialogue with one of the biennial artists, Ligia Lewis, who is a choreographer, about our process and about what we were thinking about. And she said, well, you know, it sounds to me like you're bringing together a dissonant chorus of very different voices and that the audience is in the middle of that chorus, listening to those voices.
Can you speak about, again, there were so many beautiful pieces, and like you said, large pieces. There was a piece, an amber piece, that I'd love for you to just talk about, because by the time I got to the biennial, there's all this amber that is on the floor. But it's exceptional. I think the artist was Eddie
Aparicio.
Yeah, can you speak a little bit about that work? Because there was a corner that was so sociopolitical.
I will tell you everything. So Eddie Aparicio was one of the first artists we did a studio visit with. Eddie is based in Los Angeles, and we went to his studio at a moment where there were forest fires, and it was so hot, and it was really visceral. Just being in the studio was quite something. And he immediately said, well, I want to make this this work, which is made of amber, from tree amber. And so the studio visit was extraordinary, and we invited him. He's one of the first artists we invited to be in the show. And he said, okay, I want to make a large work that's bigger than I've ever made before, and it's going to collapse eventually, but it's made of tree amber with things embedded in it, and it's going to be about 9 foot high, maybe 10 feet high, and it's going to be wide. It's going to be like a rectangle. So from then on, Meg and I and our, as we call it, B24 team, all our wonderful art handlers and registrars and everyone we made the show with, it's very collaborative project, worked with Eddie to figure out how to show this piece. It couldn't be bigger than our elevator, for example, because it has to come up in the elevator. How was it going to stand in the space? So in the end, we designed a sort of metal cage to contain it. The thing about
See, I wasn't this, sure if that was like jail or something, but I mean, whatever.
Well, yeah, well, that's the thing. It's like, you know, this amber, it moves. It's really extraordinary. It
like
moves.
A cage. Mm-hmm.
It's like it goes towards the sun like a plant. Mm-hmm. So
oh, I mean, it physically moves. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes. So
right.
Eddie cast it, which means he melted the tree amber and embedded objects in it, including facsimiles of legal documents
oh, so
relating.
He melted. Oh, wow.
Yeah. So he melted the amber down into this shape.
Yeah.
And he embedded into it these facsimiles of legal documents relating to an indigenous massacre in El Salvador, where Eddie's family is from, in the 1930s. And so then you see these documents literally sort of trapped in the amber. And then we brought it from LA to New York and we installed it. It was very beautiful. And the sunlight goes through it. It's almost like a stained glass window. And it started to move. And every day it moved a little bit more and a little bit more, and it started leaning in on itself because it was hollow in the middle, and it moved towards the sun because we placed it right by the windows, which is where he wanted to put it. And it started to really sort of talk, T-O-R-Q-U-E, move and sort of twist. And so we thought, okay.
Oh, torque. I thought you meant torque.
They didn't start to talk. It's not that alive. It was talking through its materiality. And so, of course, visitors were absolutely mesmerized by this piece because it changed every day. It was crumbling.
It was just beautiful.
And little bits were falling off it. And we would gather around, like, concerned parents, like 10 of us from all different teams in the Whitney, to make sure, obviously, the general public were protected and that the piece didn't, you know, cause any damage. So what was it going to do next? And then 2 weeks ago, at 1 a.m., it collapsed.
Just like that.
Yeah, it collapsed. And so the next morning we got the call, and so we all rushed in, and there it was in this beautiful new state. So we immediately texted Eddie, sent him photographs, and he said, well, this is fantastic. I wish it had lasted a little bit longer, but it was always meant to do this at some point. Mm. And so now, in the rubble of the amber, you can see that these documents are exposed, and you can read them a little more clearly, and you can see the sculpture. It's almost as though the sculpture being made of tree amber, which the tree secretes as a response to injury, it's almost like the body was kind of collapsing under the weight of the trauma and the memory.
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM, and we're talking to Chrissy Iles.
I think what I love about that piece, and also the Louis Kong piece?
Lotus Kong,
that it deals with time. That it's not the same piece today, it will be from a month from now.
It's so funny that you say that, because what I loved about it was the socio-political dimensions of it.
And well, it's both.
Yes, exactly. But you know, I didn't even think of time. It's so funny. But but that's another thing I learned. I go into the space with who I am. You know, we bring our lived experience to the art.
But it's almost counter to this idea about, you know, preserving art as a static state.
Interesting. I also have one more that I want to talk to her about.
Okay.
Well, a couple.
Just one.
The other one was the piece. It was Keyan Williams.
Yes. So Keyan Williams is a young artist based in Brooklyn, and we invited them to make a sculpture for the sixth floor terrace. We have two terraces, and Keyan Williams made a piece for us called Ruins of Empire. So they said, I would like to create a work that's basically like a government building with a classical architrave and pillars leaning on its side.
It was something.
Appearing to sink into the ground.
Outside, but
And this work, like most of Kian's sculptures, some of which are large scale, some smaller, is covered in earth. And the earth has substance mixed with it so that it's resistant to rain and the weather. And so this sculpture is on the terrace, and at first you couldn't see it because Eddie's sculpture...
Oh, blocking the view, right.
Blocking the view, and you had to move around to go out onto the terrace and see it. And now that Eddie's piece has collapsed, you can see Kian's piece through the windows. So the time you were talking about, Eli, is also the time of the exhibition, because your view of what's there in the show changes.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Right. Interesting.
And so before it was layers of these crumbling edifices, and now you can directly see one over the other.
And another thing was this theme around trauma. Can you speak to us about that?
You know, we had no preconceived notion of what the show should be beforehand. We decided we would listen to the artists and form the framework for the show out of the conversations we had and what the artists were telling us and thinking about. Over and over again, as we traveled the country and talked with artists, we did over 200 studio visits, it was really noticeable to us how much the artists were talking about trauma, memory, the body, the unsafety of the body, moving into very much a kind of interior sense of reflectivity. They talked a lot about psychoanalysis and really reflecting on what had just taken place over the last 2 or 3 years with COVID. And so the idea of trauma kept re-emerging and as a subject that the artists were dealing with. What's very striking in the exhibition and as we brought the show together was the way in which artists are either talking about trauma through materiality, but they're also talking about these larger arcs of history, trauma in history, specifically the 1930s. Some of the artists don't know each other at all. But so Eddie dealing with that indigenous massacre in the 30s. Diane Severin-Nagoyan's Red Room video installation that looks at the Nanking massacre in China in the 1930s. Then we have Madeleine Hunt Ehrlich, Too Bright to See, who's really lifting up Suzanne Césaire, the Martinican thinker and writer, the 1930s, not a genocide or a massacre, but the trauma of being obscured by her much more famous husband, Aimé Césaire, founder of Negritude. And so this lifting up of Suzanne into the light, the trauma of the 18th century French colonial histories with the Dominican Republic and Haiti, as they're now known, with Ligia Lewis's piece. You know, this even the Isaac Julian's arguments about unfinished modernisms, where he's trying to bring together three stories, one of which is the restitution of African objects back to the continent of Africa. So there's a generational shift. You know, it's really almost 100 years to the day that many of those events took place. And, you know, so this really interesting cycle of history that we saw, as well as personal histories.
You're familiar with the term retrofuturism type exhibit? I mean, would you say, and then for those who don't know what that is, basically what it is looking back to looking to the future. Mm-hmm. Would you say there's elements in that at all? Or?
Definitely. I mean, I think I think that's what's happening at the moment is a real, we've reached a precipice. We really have. And I think that the current moment is really, we're really in the 21st century now. You know, every century begins in the last one and ends in the next one. And so we're really at this kind of overlap point where we're truly moving into this century now. And there are so many questions that artists are asking that are really articulating what we're all feeling.
So I'm wondering, in terms of, in what ways does this particular biennial challenge traditional notions of exhibitions and making and curation?
And I think one of the things you'll really notice about this biennial is the ways in which we've given space for larger installations. Mm-hmm. You know, there are many, many, many galleries in New York, many museums, art fairs. There's so many opportunities to see art, but art that you can see in those places tends to be majority sculptures, paintings, photography, you know, objects. Less seen are installations, and yet they're a very, very important part of the way in which artists are working, and always have been, actually, for the last almost 100 years. So what we've focused on in this show is really giving space for some of those installations to be seen in their entirety. As sometimes we've brought works from that we saw in Europe or beyond or in other museums in different parts of the country so that they can all be brought together in New York and seen by a New York audience for the first time.
You know, I was very intrigued by the title of the show, which is even better than The Real Thing. And I'd just like to get your thoughts on, you know, what does it represent and how you came about it and how does it manifest itself in the show?
Yes, I mean, the title is a playful way to ask a very serious question, or questions plural, really, about what constitutes real. I mean, you could argue that America itself is a kind of fiction.
Yes, you could.
And, you know.
Oh, my God, I got to change my passport.
America is unique in that sense, in the way it's constructed and what it means to be American. You know, also AI and the appearance of AI, which, of course, has been with us since the 1950s, but the appearance of it in a new form with ChatGPT and all the different shifts that are suddenly occurring with AI, the sovereignty of the voice, of the self, of the of our own images. There's also the idea of the real in terms of, as Meg says so eloquently, the black community, and as a member of the black community saying, well, you know, we were once not considered real, you know, and right. What that means. And, you know, the same now with the trans body, and people are questioning the trans body. Is the trans body real? And so these notions of prejudice and ideas of what constitutes the real, really, and how those say much more about the person saying that and thinking that than what they're saying or considering to be real or not. And so just asking all kinds of questions about that. The show is predominantly artists of color and predominantly queer, and it, asking a range of questions, including what it means to actually, whose reality is it? Whose reality are we talking about? And America is a very diasporic place, and also reality means different things to different people diasporically too. So there are many, many layers to that question. There are also that playful reference to, you know, the real thing with a drink we shall not name, as well as to a rock band who we also shall not name. You know, all these kind of playful ways to ask these very serious questions.
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM, and we're talking with Chrissy Iles. You know, that whole concept of real is just, you know, again, who gets to determine that, so to speak, especially when you're speaking of your own identity. You talked about museums being imperfect spaces in a constant state of change and contradiction. And I think part of what you're saying now refers to that. Can you elaborate a bit more on what you mean when you say that?
Yes. Museums are places that deal with the past, the present, and the future all at once. And so they're spaces where you bring different cultural moments and ideas and layers of art history together to really ask questions about who we are. Who we are as a society, who we are as individuals, how we relate to each other, and what that means. And by bringing together the past, present, and future within one institution, also through the collection as well as an exhibition program, it really allows you to ask some of those questions that are constantly in flux.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you know the history of museums? It's kind of interesting in a lot of ways.
What do you mean?
How the museum came about. Well, like, I think you already call this the fourth generation museum because it is part of the future, it's media, stuff like that, but it started with, you know, different colonial powers going into the place and taking artifacts back, and then Sir Reginald would stick it in his house and his wife would say, get this stuff out of here, and right?
The first museum was actually in Africa.
Who knew?
Exactly.
Thank
true?
You.
The first museum in the world was in Alexandria.
Oh, right, that's right.
In Egypt.
That's right,
in Egypt. Mm-hmm. And it was a museum in the form of a kind of intellectual center with a library and with different objects.
That's
so
artifacts
in a way, there are three, you could say, different kinds of museum. One is that kind of museum where it has an intellectual, it really is a very, it has an intellectual base. Mm-hmm. And that was Africa where it started. where everything started, actually. The second model is in the Renaissance with the Medici, who brought together extremely beautiful and high-quality examples of art by Michelangelo, etc. The third model of the museum is the Cabinet of Curiosities,
right, this is what I'm
which
sort of got
is Peter the Great really championed that, and that was in the 17th century, brought together all kinds of different objects that weren't necessarily artworks, but it was objects from different... that's the beginning of a sort of taxonomic, by which I mean ordering of lots of different kinds of things from all over the world or from whatever caught this person's eye. And so those are really the three models of the museum. You could say the contemporary museum, somewhere like the Whitney Museum, and this is also what makes the Whitney unique, is that it was founded by an artist, Gertrude Vanderbilt Whitney, in the 1930s, speaking of the 1930s. And actually, by the way, all the museums in New York, the three major museums, the Guggenheim, MoMA, and the Whitney, were founded by women.
Interesting.
In the
1930s. I didn't realize that.
In the middle of the Great Depression, which is also interesting. And so there is something kind of also recuperative about the museum, or healing, something about trying to bring the best of us together at a moment of crisis that the museum, in a modern contemporary sense, is related to.
I wonder how you reach out to audiences.
The most, I'll start with the most recent, and which is so exciting way we've done that, and this for us is just the beginning. We have made Free Fridays. We started that a few weeks ago, where the museum is for free, open for free from 5 p.m. to 10 p.m. every Friday, and free Sundays. Every other Sunday is free.
Oh, that's wonderful. My daughter said to me, I've been to the Whitney. I said, really? Yeah, there you go.
So immediately what we noticed was a much younger audience. Mm-hmm. And a much more diverse audience.
That's great.
And we had 5,000 people on one night alone, and this is the average for a Friday night. Now, that shows that there is a huge enthusiasm for coming to a museum and seeing shows, not just the biennial, but all shows. Mm-hmm. Some of them are on the seventh floor looking at the permanent collection. Very young age group and very diverse. Now, the other thing is the exhibition program itself. So how to create a diverse exhibition program so that you are speaking to different audiences who are interested in everything, but who also see themselves. And so that that requires a diverse curatorial team.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. So we have a diverse curatorial team, and that's evolving and increasing all the time, too.
And their ideas are welcome.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely. And so, you know, we are trying to make sure that also the collection, because our exhibition program is very connected to and related to our permanent collection, is also very diverse. So we bring in, and again, we're constantly discussing this together. What are our priorities? Our priorities at the moment are Black women, especially from the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, who've been neglected. And you'll see there are several Black matriarchs in this show, incredible painters.
Oh, yes.
It was the men who got discovered first, but there's Suzanne Jackson, there's Mary Lovelace O'Neill, there's Mavis Pusey. We are so proud of them.
I saw Mavis Pusey. She's Jamaican, I believe. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a beautiful exhibit.
Yes. So they are all front and center in this show. And, you know, Mavis was not known before, even though she'd shown at the Whitney in 1971 and lived and worked here. And so, you know, the program and then the collection, Free Fridays and Sundays, which enables a more diverse and also younger audience to come. And then also our education department is very, very active. It's one of the most active in the country. Really extraordinary team who reach out to teens, school groups. We take that very seriously, and we are constantly updating it, changing it.
I'm sure a lot of artists would love to be in the Biennial, and of course you can't do it with everybody. What's the process for getting attention to the curators or seeing work or getting in the Biennial?
The Biennial is a perennial exhibition. So there are very, very many different ways in which your art can be shown. The Whitney Biennial is a very harsh spotlight. And the worst thing you can do for an artist is to show them before they're ready.
Oh, so true. That's with anything almost, right?
Yes.
Right.
Sure, right. Yes. Mm-hmm. And so, sense. You know, the Whitney Biennial is also moving with the times as it must. So, you know, just as a lot of things changed during the pandemic, the way in which art was seen changed. A lot of it went online. Artists were showing in imaginative different ways because we couldn't gather together. And now that we are able to gather together, we're finding a combination of certain spaces that have closed and other spaces that have opened up and different artist initiatives happening. When you're curating a biennial, what you don't want is to curate an art fair or a degree show or something where you're walking through rooms of endless, randomly selected work that looks great but has no relationship to each other. I like the randomness of art fairs, of discovery, but there are five of them at least in the city. We don't need another one through the Whitney Biennial. That actually is boring because you've already seen so many and there's so many places to see art. What artists do want, and we've heard this from them repeatedly, is a little bit of context for what's going on, a little bit of a framework that allows you to think. So artists have come to the show and said to us, wow, you know, this is really making me think about materiality or the body, or some of the issues that this is raising are really making me rethink how I can deal with space in a city where studios are at a premium, pretty much unaffordable, and many artists are working from home. How can I make a work that occupies quite a bit of space when I'm in a studio apartment? Right. And, you know, what can I do and how can I rethink certain things because I've seen what's possible. And so the Whitney Biennial actually brings together a group of artists whose work is very strong and who, through the ideas of the show that the curators are putting together, and it changes, of course, each time, is very helpful for artists. And, you know, Suzanne Jackson said, oh, I thought I was too old to be in a biennial. We said, you're never too old to be in a biennial. So some artists have said to me, oh, it's so great to be in this biennial because, you know, the resonance of my works with other artists' works, it's not just a random appearance of your work and being shown or getting some attention. Anyone can get some attention, as Warhol said, for 15 minutes, but then what? So, you know, how to create some kind of meaningful relationship between artists and their works that tells a story and tells something of the present moment that allows artists who maybe have just left art school or maybe have been working for a while to kind of think about the context for what they're doing. Because the other thing New York loves, apart from the first 15 minutes you'll get seen, is perseverance.
Yes.
New York
yes.
is all about perseverance. And so... Well, if you're not in a biennial now, who knows?
Chrissy, this was so very informative. Going to the biennial and then hearing from you, it's made this experience so impactful.
We want to really thank you for this amazing interview. We knew it was going to be great.
To all our listeners, thank you for tuning in. For more information, visit us at artmoves.net. That's Art Moves with a Z. You can also listen to us on Apple Podcast and Spotify. Art Moves is co-produced with Brick Arts Media and recorded at Brick Studio in downtown Brooklyn. This has been Art Moves with your host, Tony Williams.
And Eli Kaslansky. Find some art that moves you and share it.